Welcome to The Peg Doesn't Fit. The Peg Doesn't Fit is a podcast about the need for an educational paradigm shift. We have not quite decided if education is the whole or if it is the peg, but one thing is for sure, it doesn't fit.
Join us each week as we explore our metaphor and discuss the need for a systematic shift in the American educational system.
My name is Eric Steven.
And I'm Ryan Bartle. Welcome to The Peg Doesn't Fit.
We have missed you guys and are super excited to be back with an excellent episode today. Before we get into the episode, though, let's kind of get caught up with our personal lives. What's been going on, Mr. Bartle?
Well, last week, my daughter got her tonsils taken out, and that was an adventure for her. I have had them taken out as well just a couple years ago, so it was just kind of interesting to see her work through the same struggles that come from the pain, but also for me, and I think she felt this too. You have to relearn how to swallow, which is kind of a fun thing to think about in a broader sense of when something happens to you, what do you do when you have to relearn something you've always done?
Did you guys go out for ice cream afterwards?
She did with her mom.
That's all I know. I never had my tonsils taken out, but all the shows I watched, I think it was a Brady Bunch episode. I mean, every time someone gets their tonsils taken out, they go out for ice cream. So, but I never got a chance to do it. But usually I go get some ice cream after I see somebody else get ice cream because that is my favorite. Well, listen, you know, this has been a crazy week because we got our kids back.
Yep.
And we're doing a little hybrid, so I can't even really think back to anything that I have done other than the fact of just doing everything that I can to try to help the building run as smooth as possible when we get kids back in the building for the first time. And it certainly has been an experience, but it has been good to see them, and I'm sure that many of you are experiencing that around the country because our kids are slowly starting to come back to school. And hopefully, eventually, we can get them all back. But right now, we are in a hybrid mode, and we only have two sets of them. Half of them come on Monday and Tuesday. The other half come on Thursday and Friday. And it has been an adventure, but we have survived the first week. So, anyway, that's what's going on with us. Let's talk about a tweet of the week. Tweet of the week. This one comes from Brad Johnson, at Dr. Brad Johnson. He says, administrators and teachers shouldn't have to devote most of their personal life to their profession to be considered highly effective. What do you think when you hear that tweet, Ryan?
Oh, about 5 million things, but some of it, I've always called it the math of teaching, or for those in the lean manufacturing world, the tact of teaching. A lot of times with our job, like a lot of other jobs, the amount of work it takes to probably feel like you're highly effective far exceeds even the hours within a day, not just a work day, but an entire day. And that's tough. So how do we, is there a way to whittle some of that down and really focus on just the kids and student learning? One more too that I thought about, and we'll get to this in our amazing episode with Ross Parker. One of his deep thoughts was to just say, you know what, we really got to think about what do we mean when we say education, when we're thinking of dreaming up something new for education? And this is kind of that same thing. What are we really meaning when we're saying highly effective?
Okay. And when I saw this, what I was thinking more along the lines of something that I've been struggling with as of late is finding balance. You know, I would never expect any teacher in a building that I am an administrator at to give up their entire life to be a good teacher. And I know some teachers do that. You know, they go home and they plan and they grade, and it just, the job sometimes, if we let it, it consumes us. And we don't want to allow our ambitions to be a good teacher cause our personal lives to self-destruct.
Yep.
You know, and I've caught myself doing that. And I know I mentioned when we came back after Christmas break that I did kind of do some unplugging, And I have really been striving to do some balance. And in fact, I've been doing a little research and trying to connect with some people on Twitter. And I do want to do a series, you know, at least one, maybe a couple of interviews with some people to talk about balancing your life. You know, how can you be an effective and still be a great teacher, yet still be a present father or mother to your children or a husband or wife or whatever, and still be a valuable component to your family, and yet still be a highly effective teacher. So those are some episodes that we're going to be looking into in the near future. But let's move on to today's topic. So Mr. Bartle, I call him Mr. Bartle because he's a teacher, but he's Ryan. Ryan D. Bartle 1. He connected with this guy on Twitter, and I'm going to let him introduce who we've got coming up, but we just had a dynamic interview with an individual who actually lives in Hong Kong. So we're continually to expand our audience, and the peg doesn't fit, and we're very excited. But Ryan, why don't you go ahead and introduce who we got coming up?
This is Ross Parker. He is a tech director and an amazing educator. And he's born and raised in Hong Kong. So that was fun to hear kind of an international perspective on schooling. He's in Hong Kong, but yet works at a school that has a lot of British influence within the kind of structure that they have. And I found him because I'm fascinated by a lot of probably open source, outside the box type things. And I found him, and he also has his own student management system, kind of like the gradebook stuff we do with PowerSchool or Synergy or whatever, or Canvas, those things you use. And I thought, wow, this guy looks pretty cool. So we had no idea, I think, what we had in store when we had Ross on. This was really incredible. He has been doing some amazing work, not only in that, you know, kind of tech sphere, but he's just a phenomenal educator. And the way he thinks about teaching is, you'll learn a lot today.
Well, let me and thank you for that introduction. And I am excited to let you guys listen to this interview. But a quick kind of entry to it. So we are going to kind of transition into some technology series. We're going to talk to a variety of people about educational technology. So Ryan is kind of a nerd, as you guys have probably identified throughout listening to this show. He likes camping and hunting, but he also really likes technology. He's into Linux and some open source stuff. So, you know, the goal of this episode was really to kind of talk about open source versus closed source technology in education. So I do want to preface this interview to let you know that it does kind of start a little bit slow, really heavy in on the technology. And I don't want that to lose some of you, because if you aren't really a technology guru, don't give up on this episode. Just kind of fast forward a little bit if you want to skip the techie nerdy stuff and get into the actual dynamics of the pedagogy that he uses to teach and how he uses that technology to diversify his lessons, because it is powerful. He's also going to give a link to a website for anybody that does want to use some of his stuff, because it is free. But again, there is some component of needing to have some experience in some technology, so you might touch base with some techie friends of yours if that's not your deal, to figure out how you can utilize something like this. But if nothing else, it's going to open your eyes to what education could be, and that is the whole point of this podcast. The peg doesn't fit, referring to whether or not the peg is education or whether or not the peg is society. Either way, the peg is not fitting in the hole, because we are stuck in this traditional mindset of what education has looked like, and we are not fully taking advantage of the tools that we have available in our modern world. Ross is going to talk about how you can combine the two. So I invite you to stick around, listen to this interview, and you are going to enjoy it. So with no further ado, here is Ross Parker. We have Ross Parker with us today from all the way from Hong Kong, which is a super exciting experience. It kind of puts into perspective how the time zones work, because we are sitting here in Kansas at 5 o'clock. And Ross, good morning to you. It's 7 a.m. over there?
Yep, just past 7, and the sun has just come up on a Friday in Hong Kong.
What's the temperature at over there?
I haven't checked this morning, but and I'm looking outside as if I can see the temperature. I haven't checked this morning, but it's probably about 13 or 14 degrees Celsius.
Okay. Which is convert that, for us over here in America, we're more on the other system.
That's probably in the 80s, maybe.
57.2 according to Google.
Oh, so a little bit
So,
cooler.
Well, how about
yeah,
that?
Hong Kong is subtropical, and whilst it's really hot and humid, like most people find it horribly hot and humid for 8 months of the year, the rest of the year it gets cool, and we all live in concrete boxes with no insulation. So when it's 15 degrees outside, it feels much colder inside. So
It kind of sounds like our school. We're at 36 degrees outside, but I bet it's about 20 in here. So
about
listen, your Twitter bio, and just in case people want to follow you, what's your handle?
right. Ross.Parker.
Russ.Parker. So on your Twitter, it says you're a teacher and a tech director. Why don't you give us a little bit about your current role and maybe your career trajectory that got you to where you are today?
So I teach at a school called ICHK Secondary, which is in the Northern New Territories in Hong Kong. It's quite a rural school. If you picture Hong Kong as sort of the famous skyline and the harbor front and bustling full of people, we're pretty much the opposite of that. And when most Hong Kongers hear about where we are, often it goes with this kind of far away, up in the distance hand motion. We're right on the border with China. So we're a through school with a couple different campuses, and I've been there for 11 years. When I started, the school was very new, only had 120 students at the secondary campus. And the school came to be because other secondary schools where our primary partner schools used to send their students had all filled up, and suddenly there were no spaces, and parents were in a difficult situation. I was really fortunate to join in the school's second year on campus. And I've been there since, just working things out on the fly, basically. I was a newly qualified teacher at that time as well, so it was sort of a series of challenges, and we've grown and learned from there. I was never really wanting to work with children. In fact, I had a degree in business and computer science and ended up working in an investment bank straight out of university. But it only took me, I don't know, about 6 weeks to realize I didn't want to spend my whole life in a cubicle, moving other people's money around. So I ended up in sports administration, working for the YMCA at a roller hockey rink that they run in Hong Kong, which is statistically highly improbable. And that job, which I took on really because I loved playing roller hockey, introduced me to coaching kids and working with kids. And from there, I sort of developed the tech side separately and ended up doing tech support in schools, which led me down the road to teaching.
So we were looking around on your website, and by the way, I think you were going to clarify your Twitter handle is Ross.Parker, but it's a DOT, not the period dot,
Yes.
correct?
Correct, which seemed like a good decision at the time. Everyone was kind of jumping over from various different systems to Gmail. I guess that was 2003 or four when they started giving out a gigabyte of free storage, and everyone was sort of like, oh, a gigabyte, it's a magical number. How are they possibly doing this? And so I looked for Ross Parker. I looked for Ross period Parker. I didn't want to go with my year of birth or a random number or something. So in the end, I settled on spelling the dot, which now every time I have to read my email over the phone, obviously
You have to clarify.
there's clarification required. But yes, thank you for clarifying that.
Well, making a Twitter handle, that's a big life decision because once you make it, it's yours.
It's generally worked okay. I don't tend to use Twitter a ton anymore. And I've only encountered one person, one colleague in real life who actually calls me Ross.Parker. It's a teacher called Jane Ellis, and I loved it. I wish I'd caught on, but no, sadly, in real life, I'm just Ross Parker.
So open source software, it seems like you definitely value that as a key player in the way we go about teaching or just as a part of our educational system. And
I think not everybody necessarily, our listeners, are familiar with the difference even between open source and closed source, that even though that's been around forever, that's a fairly new concept, I think, that's slowly gaining traction. So just can you talk about why you see value in that and what the difference is between closed and open source?
Sure. I think, 20 years ago, open source as a name didn't exist. It was called free software. Mm-hmm. And free software, free, yes, it's monetarily free, but also it's free as in liberty, right? And so it's funny in English that the word has two different meanings, cost and freedom, whereas say in French it's gratis versus liberty. And so there's always been this confusion about free software with people assuming that it's simply monetarily free. And that's why the name eventually changed to open source, to designate something that was more open and available. So closed source software is what you would buy from Microsoft or Mac. You get to use the software. Sometimes you get it for free, sometimes you pay for it. But you can't open up the software and look inside it, look at how it's made, look at the source code, which is the source in open source, look at the programming and change that software to meet your own needs. Open source then is the opposite of that. You get the software for free, yes, but you also receive the source code, not just the computer readable part of the program, but the human readable. So you can look at what it's doing, how it works. You can make changes for yourself, but you can also suggest your changes back to the originators of the software and help them improve the software. So famous open source titles would be Linux, the operating system, which actually powers Android and Chromebooks and is used on 80% of the world's web servers. So Google, Twitter, Facebook, you name it, they're all run on open source software. Ironically, Firefox, the browser, LibreOffice, those are all examples of sort of big open source projects. WordPress, the blogging platform, would be another one.
So how do you, I guess, the why for you, the value in that, how as it translates into education, what do you see there?
I think for me, the problem with most educational software is that it's produced by corporations, and fundamentally those corporations are, you know, they require a profit to survive, and profit is their motive fundamentally. And that's at odds with education, which is generally non-profit making. Even a lot of private schools, they're not profit making organizations. They charge fees, but they're not out to make a profit. And so I see a real mismatch there with schools that don't have a corporate agenda butting up against companies, getting services from those companies, which, you know, it is all fine and well, except that most commercial school software to me isn't really about meeting the needs of teachers and students. It's about meeting much more traditional organizational needs of schools, which are important, but actually which are often at odds with really good learning and really good teaching.
So most of our listeners are teachers, and some of this might be going way over their head. So in terms of open source, that's something that you've got to be used. I mean, you can't like use like open source software with like Windows, correct?
No, you actually can. You can really mix and match. And in fact, Microsoft have gone from being sort of the enemies of open source to really adopting and even fostering open source of late. But yes, you could be running Windows, whatever, Windows 7, Windows 10, and then download an application like Firefox, which is open source, and run that instead of Google Chrome as your web browser.
I got you. So I want to keep some of that focus, but I also, before we get into like what maybe some of our listeners can utilize, I'd like to just, because I remember being at a conference years ago. I was at a technology conference in Seattle, and there were a lot of different districts representing from all over the country. And there were some open source districts that were really trying some outside the box stuff. And I remember thinking that my district is so, I mean, just to get them to approve me to even purchase a software, I had to like jump over all these hoops, and they were so concerned about protection and all of that stuff. And I kind of envied these districts that were really kind of getting into the Google. They were really getting into the Google Classroom. And this was back when Google Classroom first started, you know, so they were using, I can't even remember back in the day, but what, you know, whatever the knockoff Microsoft Word processing and PowerPoints and all that stuff, they're using all that stuff. And I was very envious. But what would be some advantages and disadvantages of, say, a district going with a primarily open sourced type of technology versus the more traditional technology of a Microsoft?
So there's sort of two separate economies there. There's definitely open source and closed source. And you'll have districts that tend to be one or the other. And often that's ideological, also technological. But a lot of the time, actually, it's better to think of software at different layers. So you have your sort of online services, you have your desktop operating system like Windows, and then you have the applications that you install on top of that. And actually, any of those levels could be open or closed, and it could all be a mixture. And that's what's most likely to happen.
Okay.
The advantage for me, for an individual, I use the Firefox web browser instead of Google Chrome or Internet Edge or Safari because it's not owned by one of the five tech giants. So if you remember, there was a time when Google didn't have its own web browser and most people used Internet Explorer or one of the other browsers. And Google got into the browser business because it's the engine through which most of us do most of our work today. We spend a lot of time using websites rather than desktop apps. And as I see it, Google got into that space really because they wanted to harvest more information about us than they already could. And so for me, switching from a commercial browser to Firefox, which is nonprofit, is run by a charitable organization. And it's really about trying to build the best internet possible that's not all about advertising and hoovering up data, to me gives me as an individual a large degree of protection from that sort of corporate profit motive.
That's very good. Because I know that there's a lot of concern of Facebook and Google taking over the world and storing all our data. So what you're saying is that by using Firefox or something else other than that, you are protecting yourself in terms of your data getting into the wrong hands, so to speak.
Yeah. I mean, when you go to Google, you're still giving Google your data. But when you go to another site, you can use Firefox, and there's some good plugins as well to protect Google from tracking you from site to site.
Gotcha.
And that's where a lot of the sort of deep advertising profiling happens, because Google's an advertising company. They have adverts on millions of sites, and any one of them that you go to can suck that information back into Google's profile of you. It's easy to sound paranoid about these things. I'm not afraid of what Google will do with that information, but I'd much rather they not have it and it remain more within my control for privacy reasons.
Well, thank you for that quick breakdown. So thinking about a couple of things that you've done with open source, people look at me and come to me for tech solutions, and I can provide tech solutions on a rather basic level. I kind of understand how computers work, and there's a lot of similarities, with the right clicking and the just clicking on stuff. I can figure stuff out. But you have written a couple programs. Talk to us a little bit about Gibbon and Free Learning, that are some open source softwares that you have written. And I don't know if that's just exclusive to your school or if other people have access to that, and what exactly it is and what led you to create those.
Sure. And this is where you can sort of go from the individual choosing to use open source software to something that's much more organizational. And so Gibbon is a school platform. It does a lot of the things that you'd expect from any software that would run a whole school. So what's often called a school information management system, something like, I guess, PowerSchool is probably the biggest commercial alternative, but it also does a lot of the virtual learning that you might expect in something like a Blackboard or a Moodle. And so where most schools have those at least two fundamentally different systems, a management system and a virtual learning system, Gibbon aims to bring a lot of that functionality into one place. It's based on some closed source software that I built for a school in it's around 2005. They had recently transitioned from the British curriculum to the IB curriculum. And at that point, there just wasn't software to really help you manage a lot of the IB processes. And so they employed me to build this software. But because I was already interested in open source, I maintained ownership of the software. They got one copy of it, but I kept ownership of it. And then sort of 5-6 years later, when I wound up teaching at ICHK and I was responsible for IT there, I looked around at our systems and we didn't have anything that really met the needs of teachers, students, or parents. And so I started looking around for software that we could run as a school. The commercial software was all very expensive. It would bind us to a long-term paid relationship with a provider. And that relationship, in my experience, often goes the same. You meet the salespeople, they're very forthcoming. They tell you that they can do anything for you. You buy the software, there's a honeymoon period of getting what you want. And then after a few months, you're stuck with what you have. So I'd already long been interested in open source as just a way to build communities of people with common goals. And so I started wondering if I could take the existing software that I'd written, which was called Muse, and convert it into an open source project and really broaden it from just doing this subset of school stuff to try and encompass everything. And at that time, I was using WordPress to build a lot of websites. And I really like the WordPress model where you get a core of useful functionality, and then there are lots of modules and extensions that you can plug in to make it do different things. And so from that was born Gibbon. It comes with 20 modules that let you do what most schools want to do. So manage student data, take attendance, run sort of lessons and plan units, do after school activities, all that kind of stuff. But then it also has another 20 or so additional modules that you can plug in that let you start to do things that not every school wants to do, maybe things that are a little bit more interesting. One of those is free learning, which is the other thing you mentioned. But just to answer the one question you said, is Gibbon just an ICHK thing? No, it's not. We've turned it into a project that anyone can download, anyone can try, they can install it in their school. And what we're finding now, it's in use in several hundred schools, being translated or has been translated into 30 different languages.
Wow.
So it's getting some sort of international traction. But the most exciting thing for me is that the people who are using it are starting to say, hey, we've made it do this by editing it. Can we give you that change and can you incorporate it and then share that with other people? And those people who are using it tend to be teachers with a programming background who want to make it do things that work for their schools. So it's sort of becoming more flexible and pliable, which is where the name comes from in the first place, right? Gibbon's
absolutely. Because I know that there's, you know, and I'm sure that we have lots of listeners that their student management systems or whatever, I mean, they always think, I wish that it could do this, I wish that it could do that, you know, and then, you know, you can send an email to the company and say, hey, can you make it do this? And maybe it happens, maybe it doesn't. But what you're saying is that you have a student information system that if a school district that has some pretty good tech people were to use it, they can get in and fidget and play with it and get it to also do what they need it to do as well.
Correct. Yeah.
And that's the advantage I see between open source and closed source is that, you know, yes, open source, you got to have techie though. You got to have your own tech support for the open source, where the closed support, you do get that company to help support you.
Yeah. And that's one thing that's often misunderstood about open source is that whilst you're not paying for the software itself, there are plenty of commercial providers that will sell you the services around that. And so whilst we have our open source arm, we also have, we've started over the last couple of years to develop a commercial arm that does exactly that. So schools that want more support can then opt to pay for that. And of course, there are other companies that are providing that same support as well.
Excellent. Well, what's tell us a little bit about free learning. That's more on the educational side or?
Yep. Okay. So free learning grew out of my own teaching practice. I guess when I was newly qualified and I started teaching, I was definitely going to do things differently to other teachers. I looked around and I thought, yeah, a lot of the teachers I know are older. They don't seem super enthused. Maybe they've become a little bit jaded. But I'm definitely not going to be that teacher. I've got this university training that's all about student-centered learning. I'm going to just blow this stuff up. And, you know, for my first couple of years in the classroom, I felt I was able to be energetic, funny, good-looking, young, all of the rest. And students generally seem to engage in that at a certain level. But what I found is that that engagement was often quite superficial. They like the jokes, they like the banter, but when it came down to the real serious stuff, I got a lot of eye rolling and you know, falling asleep. And I really felt myself over certainly sort of my third, fourth years of teaching, just slowing down, not quite burning out, but definitely feeling like I now understand why there are so many less energetic teachers, because you're going to be doing this for a long time and the kids aren't necessarily filling you with energy. And so I started to really question what I was doing and what schools were doing. Our head of school, who was then vice principal, Toby Newton, is a really unusual thinker, and he's read a lot of really diverse reading around education and anthropology, psychoanalysis, a whole bunch of different fields. And so he, I think, recognized in me someone who wanted to do things differently. And he started to feed me some quite interesting reading. Ivan Illich's Unschooling Society would be a good example. And that really started to get me thinking about the fact that my classroom was really a compliance machine, right? I really wanted kids to come in, do what I said. And if they did enough of what I said, we could have some fun. But if they didn't, if they had other ideas, then, well, I was going to have to impose my will upon them. And I really started to question whether I could ever have really sort of authentic learning under such conditions. At about the same time, I watched a video by the organization Good, all about motivation in learning, and that featured Khan and Sugata Mitra talking about student choice. And then a student of mine shared a video with me about free running. And I watched this parkour video of people doing amazing things in a really constrained environment, making choices, developing their skills, and fundamentally really enjoying facing challenge. And I thought, well, what if we reimagine the classroom to be like a free-running landscape, to give kids a constrained and difficult environment, but to give them the choice of moving through that environment? And from that grew this idea of free learning. So my students today don't come to me for IT classes. They come to me for free learning classes. I introduce them to a map of about 100 different learning opportunities. Those are best visualized as a mind map, where you can start with one unit. You click into that unit. This is all built into Gibbon, so you're in the school's management system. You click into that unit, you enroll with your teacher, and you go through a set of activities and prompts. And once you produce some evidence of that learning and the teacher says, yes, you've completed this unit, it goes green and it unlocks any units that are connected to it. And so
you've just given me huge goosebumps, because I've been trying to design this on my own just as a sketch.
Okay.
You've implemented this. This is beautiful. Keep talking.
There we go. And it's free and open source. So you can download it, put it on a server, get the software. And in fact, we'll even give you a whole bunch of units if you want to start on the IT side. So I'm just going to zoom in on that. So as I said, this is all happening in Gibbon. This is the general Gibbon interface. And you can see the different things that we can do in school. And here is my ICT map. The blue circled unit is where kids start. Initially, they could hover their mouse over any other unit and find out what it is. But if they click on it, it'll say, you can't get in yet. And so they will have to complete this unit, which then in turn unlocks this unit. And you'll see it turns into what looks a bit chaotic, but it's actually quite thematic. Once you navigate these four key units, which are about what is free learning, how do I use a desktop computer, what's the school's ICT policy, and what are some useful tools for learning, you can kind of then go on this web design programming route down here. You can go on a hardware, tear down electronics, PC, build stuff route, and you can go on a creative open culture route up here.
Kind of reminds me of Zelda.
Yes, that is the aim. So to engage kids, to show them this thing and to have them say, wow, it looks so big and difficult, yet it's also exciting because I had the choice and I'm going to move at my own pace. I'm going to find what interests me. So some kids will like look up here and see like, oh, photography, or wow, I can become a movie editor, or I can get into YouTube, or a super popular one down this way. Minecraft, right? And it's not a coincidence that Minecraft is way at the edge of the map, and it goes through a ton of really useful things that I want kids to learn before they get the payoff down here. There's a whole bunch of sort of psychological trickery in here that you might find in a computer game. The initial units are set up so that you can win them quite easily. You can get through them quite quickly. They're more scaffolded. The challenge is a bit lower. But as you get outer woods in the map, the units become more complex, less structured, and harder to defeat.
I like that. So once they finish, we've talked a bit about badging, and that's probably a separate episode worth. But this reminds us of some competency-based learning we've talked about. And do kids, other than the grade out, or is it the opposite of that? When they finish it, is it grade out, or it becomes...
I'm going to switch to the student view here. I've just adjusted to see my son, who happens to be in year seven. This is my son's view. And as his parent, I can come into the system and see this view. But also as his teacher, I can see this view and that of all of his peers. So the green units are the ones that he's completed. The orange one is one that he started but hasn't quite finished yet. Mm-hmm. He kind of started that. You can see this is a kid on a mission heading in a more or less straight line with a few little divergence down to, yes, predictably the Minecraft unit.
So can the teacher click on those and see how they did?
So when I click into here, I see the unit content itself. This is what the students will see, collection of videos, text, image prompts, finishing with a task. And actually in this case, the task builds up. It's it assumes the kids probably know more about Minecraft than I ever will. It assumes that they probably played a bunch, but they could be beginners. And so it starts with some tutorials and things. It encourages them to build something in creative mode, to play with survival, and ultimately, and this is for me the real learning outcome, is to make a 1 to 2 minute video introducing Minecraft to newcomers. So they now have to put themselves in the mind space of someone else, like a parent who doesn't understand this obsession, and to succinctly communicate, like an advert, what's so amazing about this system. And it ties into some previous units that they might have done using picture-in-picture video camera, video capture, and things like that. What I can see as a teacher, I can jump over to manage enrollment. I won't do this now because it's full of sort of confidential student information. Sure. But what I see there is every student that's enrolled in this unit under my supervision, so within one of my classes or who's chosen me as a mentor, and I can have a back and forward dialogue with that student. They can ask me questions. I can respond to those questions. When they're ready, they can submit their work. And I choose whether the work is complete and approved, or whether it's what we say evidence not yet approved.
What I love about this is that it's not just, you know, like we've talked about this before in the past. Well, mostly I have. Ryan didn't really talk about it, but I mean, we did do a series on the Microsoft, you know, Microsoft's got a bunch of free courses on their website, but it's, you know, it's, you answer it and you either get it right or wrong. You know what I'm saying? But this requires the teacher to actually go in and approve it. It's not like a kid can't go home and just go through this entire map over the course of the night by answering some multiple choice questions and get through to till they get to where they want to go. You actually, as a teacher, have to go in and approve it, correct?
Yes. And for me, that was one of the real big design choices, is that this is not personalized learning. This isn't Khan Academy or the Microsoft situation that you're discussing, where a student learns from an algorithm. That's 100% not what I wanted to build. I wanted to build something that let the teacher do really good teaching work with students when students needed it, rather than writing them out of the equation. And so the assessment model is inheritively formative. Instead of having a whole batch of kids do this thing for 6 weeks and then sitting a test or writing a project and then assessing it and having moved on before they even get the results of that and never having a chance to put that feedback into action, the student is either individually or they may be working in a small group, but that subset of the whole class can cycle through that work, getting feedback, improving the work as many times as they need before then moving on to the next thing. And so it's a much more realistic way, I think, of learning in the way that, that you or I would learn if we were asked to do something, you know, hey, Ryan or Eric, can you solve this problem? You wouldn't just sit down and do it, wait till the end and get feedback and then move on.
Right.
You would do it in a cycle, an iterative cycle of doing things, getting feedback, improving, learning, and then at some point moving on.
So for those, for our listeners that can't see this at the moment, we are seeing like a giant web, and I think you explained that before, but there's some major nodes that are kind of like the center points of each learning, let's call it unit of sorts, and those are all linked. And so there are many units around those main units that are support pieces for that. So to make maybe an analogy to maybe some traditional core content, it appears like if I wanted to make a learning journey through the language arts content, and I wanted to say narrative writing and argumentative writing, I could build those as kind of the main nodes or the road stops along this journey and put supporting lessons that the students have to master on the outside of those main nodes, correct?
That is correct. Yeah.
Okay.
At school, we sometimes like to think of our main units, not just in free learning, but in some other subjects, we use the language where we say our main units are like this, a sun or a star.
Mm-hmm.
And those additional units that come off that are your planets, your satellites.
Okay.
Absolutely.
We've tried to move to a model at least one of our subjects called human technologies, where the suns are compulsory. Every teacher who's teaching that subject, we want them to cover the suns, but there's tons of different planets that they could take the kids to do different things depending on what they feel that class would benefit from at that time. And so all what that has in common with free learning is instead of a linear step-by-step progression, you've got a lot more choice, a lot more variety. And of course, that's interesting for students and teachers alike.
So in our language, I could see those stars being standards, you know?
Yes.
So this is your standard, and this is the most important thing that you have to learn, but these are different components of that standard that will help you dive deeper into the standard. But I'm super happy if you just understand the star.
Correct. Yeah.
Now, do you, because a lot of our listeners, probably most of them, aren't technology teachers. You have this set up for other contents?
Yes. So we have, as well as the map that I just showed you, we have other maps for other subjects. And so when the students are doing free learning with me in year seven, my one goal is to skill them up on the tech side to get them ready for everything that school's going to throw at them. My other aim is to get them good at free learning and to help them become more independent. As they move into the end of year seven and then into year eight and year nine, we start introducing them to other maps that we've built with other subjects. So we actually have a PE map, an English map, a maths map, a science map, an arts map. And the kids start to get into those based on their interests. And it's really nice for me seeing some of the older kids who, you know, they'll come to their free learning class and they'll say to their teacher, we're working on the PE map and we're doing a set of units on volleyball. Is it okay if we go downstairs and start practicing? And so you'll get these groups of kids doing different sports without a teacher immediately present. But still reporting back to that teacher by recording their evidence and working through those units. And it's a very different model of what school might look like. However, I also do teach examined subjects where we have to deal with standards and exams and all of the rest. And so I teach media studies, and what I'll show you on screen now is my media studies map that is for the British curriculum GCSE media studies. And this is a bit of a different proposition because I'm telling the kids to do well in the exam in 2 years' time, you're going to have to complete basically the whole map. With the year sevens, the map is intentionally too big to ever complete. I'd be worried if a kid completed the whole map because, you know, why are they spending so much time on this one thing? Why aren't they enjoying all other parts of life? But for this map with the older kids, now I'm saying no, your aim really is to finish all of it. You still get to choose what order to do it in. You still get to time yourself and choose where to prioritize and how much time to spend. And you can still choose to work individually or with friends, but the focus is now slightly different. And this has produced some really strong exam results without a lot of pressure, without homework, without a lot of grades, without a lot of tests. The kids just sort of are supported in getting on with their learning. So different facets of the same model.
What you are talking about, and I'm so glad that you're on our show, and I'm going to try to figure, I might start a Peg Doesn't Fit YouTube so I can put some of this on so people can see it. This is kind of the reason we started this show. You know, I mean, education was invented, well, not invented, but formalized, you know, somewhere around the 1800s. Ryan actually showed a picture one time to me of education back in the 1300s, which still looked very similar to what it looks like now. You know, people sitting in rows, there was a person sleeping and there was a couple people talking and not paying attention. I mean, the human experience is the human experience, and it's happened the same way over time for a lot of the reason, just because it's just the way we've always done it. We feel that the world is at a place right now to where we can do things that we've never been able to do. We can deliver education and students can learn in ways that have never been available to them in the past. Yet we continue to teach the way we've always taught because that's just the way we do it. This is fascinating to me. How can somebody else that is not in your school district, that's over here in America, that's listening to this show, that might get inspired, can they use this?
Yes. The first route is the harder route, and so maybe it should be the second route. But anyway, the first route would be to speak to someone you know that is technologically savvy to help you install Gibbon and the free learning module. We've got a great sort of community where, you know, we have a forum and people help each other and share their units, and we're working to formalize that a little bit. But if people are just intrigued by the model and want to see what it feels like, we do have a public installation that I'll jump over to now called Gorilla PD. So the address is gorillapd, like professionaldevelopment.org. And this is a public website that anyone can come to and register as a student. They can jump in and see a map of different learning opportunities aimed at teachers for professional development. And they can sign up and get started with a unit and try progressing through a map. And that's probably the quickest way to get a sense of what free learning feels like. If I show you very quickly, I'll just sign in. And you can see there's a recommended first unit that's a welcome. And it walks you through what free learning is and how to get started on this website. And after that, I'll just show you the map very quickly. The map's pretty chaotic because we've got a bunch of different things going on in here that are kind of all mixed together. So I'll just filter down on just the sub-map that we call EdTech. And you'll see something similar to what we're offering students. It's a little bit smaller, but it covers ways that teachers can improve their own use of technology in the classroom. I had been thinking,
oh, wouldn't this be great as a teacher to use? I would enjoy my PD. if I went through this and this was this kind of journey. So this is great.
Yep. And the whole model, the software is set up so that when you create a unit, you can make it available for different audiences. So you can say, this is a student unit, or this is a teacher unit, or this is even a parent unit, if you wanted to offer sort of parent education through this model. And so, yes, we've used this. I'm actually working with a group of Hong Kong schools at the moment through the government to use this for professional development of teachers in exactly the way that you describe. So if any of your listeners are interested, they can jump into that first unit and they can you know, go through the content, but they can actually enroll choosing, I'd love for them to choose me as a mentor. They'll see anyone who's completed the unit before comes up as a mentor. So it's quite a big list. But if they were to choose me as a mentor, I would then be notified that this person wants to work with me on this unit. I'll accept that notification. They can then chat with me and ask me questions. And when they're ready, they can submit the work. I'll give them some feedback. I'm always really nice to teachers. You know, sometimes I'm strict with my students, like, you could definitely do this better. Teachers tend to get a slightly easier ride. we'll move them through that first unit, and then they can progress through the map, signing up again with me as their mentor as they go through different things.
So this is all web-based?
Correct.
So yeah, when I hear open source, you know, it makes me think, oh, wow, I use Windows. I can't use that. I have to have a Linux machine. But it's what you were talking about when we started. I mean, it's kind of stacked. Even though it was built with an open source mindset, it's able to be used on any device.
Correct. Yeah. So this actually, the software is open source. This runs on an open source software, on an open source server, but it's available to anyone with a browser. It works desktop. It works mobile. You can use it on a tablet. It's really open. And one of the reasons we went with a web-based solution rather than, say, an app solution, which is super popular, there's apps for everything, obviously, is that if you build an app, you basically have to build four copies of it. You have to build it for Windows, Microsoft, Windows, Mac, iOS, and Android. But if you build a web-based app, you just build one version and anyone can access it through their browser. So
not all students are driven to do this. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. I mean, in a perfect world, you can have your kids come in, say, hey, open up this website. This is our map for the year. Go, you know, and just kind of help the kids as they are, because they're all going to be at different levels, which is great because it's differentiated and they get to follow their interest, yet they're still learning the key concepts because you probably have it set up to where they probably have to hit every star, even though they can choose a certain star first to get where they want to go later. What do you do for those kids that just don't go?
I think educationally, the typical answer to that is to slow everyone else down in order to have some hope of pulling those kids along behind them, right? Sort of the No Child Left Behind Bush era model. One of the key phrases I've used for a long time with free learning is that, you know, slack is going to slack. Sometimes you're just going to get a kid who's really not going to have the appetite, the resources, the motivation, what have you. But rather than seeing it as leaving them behind, the way I see it is actually this gives them a very pressure-free environment in order to make mistakes, to explore, and to slowly be drawn into learning. And I think a lot of those kids that we see that don't want to learn are fundamentally afraid of failing and have a lot of practice at not keeping up, of keeping a low profile, of pretending they get things or pretending that they're too cool for this stuff. Actually, they're just afraid of being left behind. What they get here, they may get a sense that their peers are off doing other interesting things, but it's not quite as threatening because there's no direct comparison because they're not doing the same things. So it gives you a chance to then really sit with those kids individually and say, hey, look, I noticed you've been on this unit for 6 weeks. The unit suggests that maybe this should take you a couple of hours. That's just a rough guide. It's different for everyone. But I'm really interested, like, why are you particularly finding this difficult? And sometimes you'll get a kid who just says, I can't focus, or I'm bored, or I'm not interested. But often you'll get a kid who says, actually, this unit asked me to record a video of myself, and I'm just really afraid of recording the video. So then you can work out, is that a level of fear that you can overcome within that student's learning? Push them out of their comfort zone into their learning zone. All right, let's get the kid to do the video. If it's like a terror zone thing for them where they're definitely going to freak out, then just adjust the task, give them another route to succeed, and then get them going again. But it takes a real different mindset. We're so used to expecting to be held accountable that for every student we've checked these 20 boxes, that we've said, yeah, we've done this and we've done this and we've done this. And it doesn't matter if we've done it terribly. It doesn't matter if the kid only pretended to learn it or forgot about it the next day. As long as the box is checked, that's fine. What this needs us to do as teachers is to really get rid of that mindset of giving every kid the same basic minimal experience and accept that we're all individuals. We're all going to learn differently. And actually, the most important thing is that we're learning and we're getting better at learning. We're learning how to learn rather than the stuff that we're learning.
I love that.
Sorry, I got a bit excited there. That was my.
That's fun. This is right up the alley of the kind of stuff we like to hear people doing.
You've gotten me excited. I think this is brilliant. It is a little overwhelming thinking that I might have to create something like that, but you know, I appreciate that you have that avenue set up for teachers that are interested in this, that they have that PD avenue that they can kind of start getting their feet wet and exploring how something like this might work.
Yep. I think we will definitely have to create this YouTube channel so people can see. These visuals are key to really getting excited about this. I think it'll translate okay over the, the audio, but to see it is really incredible. I think we're kind of headed down this same avenue about just talking about grading. When you're thinking about individual experiences, formative assessment versus summative assessment. So I was, you know, poking around on your website and I saw you of your speaking engagements, your picture said behind you on the screen, I hate grades, which I love. I like to say grades are stupid and it makes Eric cringe a bit. So just tell us what's behind that statement.
So that was, that picture came from a teach meet. And you know, we have a great organization in Hong Kong called 21st Century Learning. They do a bunch of PD opportunities. And one of the things pre-COVID they used to do with these monthly or bi-monthly teach meets where you could go in and do a 2-minute presentation or a 7-minute presentation. You sit through a bunch of presentations, learning different things. You have a beer, you have a snack, and then you chat, right? And so I used to present a lot of like Gibbon and free learning stuff there. And well, there's only so many times people wanted to hear me say the same thing over and over. So I thought this month I'll go in and do something really different. So I actually just did a 2-minute nano presentation on I hate grades. The keen observer of that picture might notice that I wrote it in Comic Sans because I also hate Comic Sans.
So does Ryan.
Yeah.
The worst font ever made.
Yep. So I use that one deliberately to get a rise, particularly out of those primary school teachers who love Comic Sans. but fundamentally, I think grades just sap the joy out of learning. If you ever have a chance to listen to or read Alfie Kohn's work about this, he basically says the moment you give grades, what you're doing is telling students that grades are what count. And that was my experience. When I started teaching, I would craft a unit that would last, say, 6 weeks. And I'd guide the kids through it. And I thought this should be a life-changing experience. I'm introducing them to these amazing ideas and skills. And at the end, I'd say, right, let's reflect. Why did we do this? And they'd all say, to get a good grade. And inside, I would just, you know, weep a little bit. What I started doing is giving fewer grades. And at the same time, the school started asking me to give fewer grades. At some point, as Toby, who I mentioned earlier, moved from being vice principal to principal, we started doing more together about reducing grades. And ironically, because I hate a lot of assessment, I became in charge of assessment at my school. And so I've been able to push that line more. And now we actually don't give any grades in year 7, 8, or 9. And you can see a direct correlation between that and students liking school more and understanding that school is about learning, not about pleasing someone to get validation from them to keep your parents off your back.
That is brilliant. Okay, listen, we've been on this show for a while, and I mean, I could talk to you all night. This has been really eye-opening, mind-blowing, and right aligned with my vision of how we can use the technology that we have in our world to modify instruction. You know, I was going to ask you an earlier question about how do you differentiate, but I think you've made it very clear how that takes place through this software. So let's get to wrapping up. You know, we've kind of already talked in our podcast is about the need for a shift in how we do things. We need to break away from the mold we've been using the last couple hundred years. And granted, there have been some things that are happening, but the overall structure is still the same. If you could change one thing about education, I know you've talked about a lot of the stuff you're doing, but just kind of to wrap us up and to just focus us in, what is maybe the biggest thing that you see that could practically be changed within the system of education to help us move more towards a modern delivery method?
Oh, how long have I got to answer that question?
I don't know. Maybe we'll have Ross Parker dot part two.
Yeah, we might have to do a part one, part two.
Okay, well, that definitely sounds interesting. I think, you know, I mentioned Ivan Illich, and I'd really like to just blow school up, like just to completely destroy it and start again. However, whenever I think people have tried to do that, it results in chaos, right? You say to your students, okay, we're not going to do this regular school stuff. We're going to do some inquiry, and it's chaotic. And within half an hour, someone's done something really stupid and you've had to shut it all down and go back to traditional teaching because that's what works, right?
Yes.
And so with software solutions, what we find is that on the one hand, a lot of software solutions simply re-encode school into a different format. And then the really interesting software that does things differently just gets strapped onto school and becomes really school-like. And so neither of those approaches end up changing anything. What we really need to do is have a very deep and profound conversation about what school is, what assumptions are built into school. We really need to interrogate the language we use around school. So I know uniform's not big in North America, but it is in, you know, Britain and a lot of places that are influenced by British history. And so uniform is, I love to interrogate uniform. Yes, it's clothing that we wear, but it's also a state of uniformity. Why do we feel the need to make all kids the same? Why does it upset us when some kids start acting differently to other kids? How can we learn to respond not by being upset, but by looking at the deeper psychological reasons in that child's makeup, in that particular age? You go back to Eric Erickson's, you know, fifth stage about identity and role confusion. There's so many great theories that we can bring to really reimagine what school is. I think that's where the conversation needs to start. Not ad hoc solutions, not pedagogical changes, but fundamentally, who are we as people and how do we want to raise our young? As I said, I've been super lucky to find myself in a school that has been grappling with those questions in those ways for a number of years. And I can understand that if you're individually grappling with those questions and you're in a school that is not, that must be very frustrating and challenging.
Which is the other question I ask, because how do you envision, because yes, we do have a lot of isolated educators that think like this, you know, and they may be within buildings that don't operate under that, or maybe the building does, but then there's always a district above the building. So if the building is trying to do something outside the box, yet your district puts certain conformities on you, you know, you kind of have to still operate with the district expectations. And then you may have a district that wants to get a little bit outside the box, but then, and you know, I'm talking about America, but then you've got a state, you know, you've got state legislators and state education departments and guidelines that say you have to do this. And I don't know of any real states that are getting outside the box, but if you were to get a state outside the box, then you've got the federal government, you know, that maybe has a little bit of control. So there's so many different layers. And we brought this up in terms of getting away with grades, because it does deter from the learning. But then you've got universities that look at grades for admittance to see if you can get in. So, and I know we don't have enough time to tackle the entire complexities of what it's going to take to make a shift, but it's pretty insurmountable, and it's easier to fall back into the traditional form, because making a shift is going to require a significant change system-wide. And that's our struggle. And I don't, you know, I don't have any, I don't even know what to think about that.
Yeah, I think you're right. We're really hamstrung. Our hands are tied. The odds are against us. I find it really interesting that the media portrays teachers in one of two ways. We're either bumbling, incompetent idiots that can't do anything else, or we're super inspiring revolutionaries who are so fomenting true trouble, right?
Right.
And I think to an extent, we have to embrace that second role. We have to. And it's difficult when it's your profession, when you're legally bound to certain standards, when it's your livelihood. At the same time, we have to be willing to take certain risks to push the envelope and do the things that are right for our students, even if that brings us into conflict.
Right.
And that's where your sort of dangerous minds, dead poet society kind of teachers, it's hard to be that teacher, because everything is set against making you as uniform as a teacher as possible. But yeah, you got to try and bust out of that. Top down, I don't know. Have you heard of the Mastery Transcript Consortium?
Absolutely, we have. And we actually had Corey Henwood on, who is an innovative technology leader in a district in Utah, and he's actually kind of inspired us because he says that Utah, you know, there's been some legislative laws written to force universities in Utah to accept that mastery transcript. So, I think that some steps are moving, and we love that mastery transcript. I know Ryan brought up in the beginning about badge. You know, we think that it'd be really cool if, you know, and your software really sets itself up nicely to where each kid could have like an individual backpack, you know, and once you master one of those stars, or let's say that we aligned it with state standards and we had a star for each state standard, then they would master that star and they'd get that backpack that would go in their, they get that icon that goes in their digital backpack that then goes with them from wherever they go. And then that becomes like a staple on that mastery standard or a mastery transcript to demonstrate proficiency in that particular area.
Yes. Something like you can see on screen now that is our mastery transcript implementation.
Awesome.
Yeah, so we jumped in with mastery a year or so ago, and we've had some graduates last year. And it was a real great process of revisiting a lot of things that we thought about our school and saying, what's most important that we want to qualify our students in? But as a model, I think the fact that they've positioned themselves very cleverly between high school and university and they're advocating in both directions, that's the kind of top-down innovation we need to look at to then support those individual teachers. And it's amazing to hear that story from Utah that I hadn't heard to know that they're actually starting to make legal inroads, not just sort of cultural or policy inroads, is really, really inspiring to hear.
Yeah. And we talked to them, and, you know, if you got a student that's wanting to go to another state, I mean, ultimately, if another university will not, and that mastery transcript is kind of that middle person, you know, they talk to the other university to explain what their transcript means. And if they just refuse to accept it, well, then they'll just convert it to grades and shoot them another one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so. I think it's, there are pockets everywhere. And Eric's heard me talk ad nauseum about the interoperable learner record that the U.S. Chamber of Commerce is looking into and using blockchains to essentially create interlinked badges that are tracking these things. But they're, so even at the federal level, you know, they're looking at this, and our national clearinghouse that works with the universities on their transcripts are seeking to honor a lot of these things. And they're, you know, right now we're in those early, you know, what do you call those first days, the Iron Age, not even that, Stone Age of all of these things. But I think stuff is at work. And as technology progresses and the momentum builds, those things will start to grow because, you know, pilot programs are out there at the university level, at K-12, you're doing this in Hong Kong, you know, there's stuff around the world and pockets will slowly grow.
I think the role that you two are playing is fantastic as well, to bring together people who are thinking similar things to sort of stir the pot and stimulate some cultural exchange, I think is vital. So keep doing more of this.
Thank you.
Well, I'm so honored that you joined us today, because this has been very enlightening. Just kind of a last minute thing. I mean, if a teacher were wanting to look at this and understand this, can you maybe give out your contact information? We'll put it in the show notes and make sure that people know how to get a hold of some of this stuff and look at it and possibly even try to use it.
Sure. So at Ross D-O-T Parker on Twitter. I don't tweet a lot anymore, but I do keep an eye on it. That's how Ryan and I connected. So I check it every few days. So if you drop a message there, either direct message or a mention, I'll get onto that. Through my website, which is just rossparker.org, you can contact me there. Just, you know, leave a comment or email me through the site. And I'd be more than happy to chat with any individual or school or district or whoever to try and support any of these kinds of conversations. You know, Gibbon's freely available, and I like to talk about that a lot, but I'm not a software salesman. I don't have anything to sell you. I'm just really interested in conversations about students, teachers, teaching and learning.
Well, thank you very much. It has been a pleasure. And, you know, we hope that we'll keep following you on Twitter. We hope you pick up some Twitter followers And I certainly hope that that some of our people have listened to you and will consider shifting at least, you know, a little bit about what they do. And then hopefully someday they can take the leap of faith to actually make the entire shift. So thank you. It was a pleasure.
Yep. Thank you so much for having me. And yeah, enjoy your Thursday evening. And the sun's now up here, so I'll get my Friday morning going.
All right. Thank you, Ross.
Thanks, Ross. All right.
Cheers. Thanks, Ryan. Thanks, Eric.
Oh, wow. What an episode. Eric, what did you think of that?
Well, you know, like I said in our intro, in terms of getting past the technology, I mean, yes, the open source versus the closed source, I get that there can be a lot of advantages and disadvantages in those two, but really what stuck with me the most in this episode is the free learning software. And it's just, it's got my mind wandering, and I brought this up a little bit in the interview, but you know, as we've talked about before, our district is moving towards the standards reference grading. I could see something like this, like I brought up in the interview with Ross, is each of those stars that he referred to as being standards. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And underneath those standards, you know, so say the star itself is the most understanding of that standard at the most basic level. And once you can understand, and it kind of reminds me going back to David Frangiosa, when we were talking to him in terms of, can you identify and define, you know? Yeah. And once you can understand it at the basic level, then the teacher is able to open that, the rest of that star solar system up to where you can access some of the planets underneath the star and start to dig a little bit more in to show a little bit more proficiency. And it's got my mind, I mean, I wish that I knew how to code and try to get in here and do something like this, because I think that this is something that teachers can do. And this is what we're talking about in terms of the technology, using technology, but not completely taking the teacher out of the equation either. So I love it. I'm so glad that we had the opportunity to meet with him. And to be honest with you, it has blown my mind, because I was really expecting more of a technology session, but really we ended up talking about using a technology platform as a pretty strong indicator, or not indicator, but pedagogical style of diversifying your lessons.
What really... That really deeply resonated with me. I feel it in my gut even. I was so excited to see some of this, in the sense that he's using technology as a tool, and I still think that we as educators are still using technology as a dangly carrot to create something that already, and Ross talked about this, we're taking something that already is and just throwing technology at it to kind of make it a little bit more glittery and glitzy.
Right, like let's not write the paper, let's type it, and I'll let you change the font color.
Right.
And that's not really enhancing what you're doing. Might even be slowing you down if the kid can't type.
Exactly, and it's not that. It's actually the facilitation tool, which is really my dream for technology. As much as I geek out about it, that's all I see. That's the main purpose I see, is it is a facilitator to enhance the learning and essentially track or make the learning, you could call it more efficient, but essentially just guide kids better with it. And what he hit on later that I really loved, not only does this honor the kids' learning path, so they don't have to travel through that solar system in the same directions at the mm-hmm. same pace, but the teacher's not out of this equation either. You know, we like that Microsoft education stuff we do, but that doesn't involve a teacher saying that I learned anything. And I really don't have to prove anything other than I can pass a quiz at the end.
A multiple choice one.
Right, a multiple choice quiz. But yet this one actually requires some kind of learning product where the kid's proving they know what they learned, and the teacher must say, you know what, that's good. And it also and that's a little bit summative, and that's okay, but it also provides checkpoints of formative assessment by the teacher along the way as well, which is beautiful.
Absolutely. So, you know, this podcast is about finding educators that think alike and think that we can do something differently. If any of you are interested, are doing anything that's outside the box, that is really something different than the traditional, please reach out to us. We have our new Twitter account. that has picked up some followers. So we'll kind of see how that goes and post on it from time to time. But you can find us on Twitter at The Peg Doesn't Fit. You can find my personal Twitter at Eric J. Steven. Ryan, what's your personal Twitter?
At Ryan D. Bartle 1.
Do not forget the 1.
Yep.
As always,
I don't know who that guy is.
You can email us. I don't know who that other guy is. At thepegdoesn'tfit@gmail.com. We're still waiting for that first voicemail at anchor.fm/thepegdoesn'tfit. Just click the little leave a message button and we'll get a voicemail and actually put your recording on our show. And then you can always go on and listen. If you like what we're doing, go on to Apple Podcast and give us a 5-star review, or maybe just leave us a little note. We'll read what you have to say and we'll be very appreciative of your 5-star comment.
And it helps spread the word to other educators. And for me, that's the most important part about growing this audience or this network, is the more people we reach, the more people we get to meet and then find out about and learn from. And the more you all get to learn from, too.
Absolutely. And one of the benefits of this podcast, and notice we don't have any advertisements. We're not here to make money. We are here to grow professionally. And in the 14 episodes that we've done so far, I have learned so much and connected with so many people that it's been worth it for me. And I hope that you guys have gotten something out of it. And we appreciate it. If you like what we're doing, share with your friends so we can make sure and get this message out to as many people so we can start to see some systematic shifts in education throughout our country. So as we stated at the beginning, we are kind of beginning our technology series. So the next few episodes that we have, we are going to be talking about technology and education, not as technology as, hey, do this and I don't have to do anything, how we can use technology to enhance what we're already doing. And down the pike, we're going to have some leaders in. We're going to talk about leadership and how we can possibly move in this direction. And then coming full circle back to our tweet of the week, I do want to bring some people on and start talking about some balance and how can we do these outside the box things without completely giving up our personal lives.
Thanks for tuning in, and we will see you next time. Bye.